Boyd. Up next on The Best of Think, a conversation about the anxieties of fame with comedian John Hodgman.
The imposter syndrome is something we all suffer. We're all, no matter how good we are at a thing, some part of us worries that we're going to be found out and we're terrible. And that's a comforting thing it's a comforting story to tell. But I think it's an equally comforting story to appreciate. Sometimes we are imposters. Sometimes we are pushing ourselves beyond the limits of comfortable fraudulency into worlds that we know nothing about. And it is good to be called out when that happens, to be able to resituate and realize I have to learn. I have to do better.
We'll also talk with Hodgman about his relationship to status and identity when it comes to being famous. Our Best of Think conversation starts after a short break. John Hodgman has experienced things most of us will never encounter. He's availed himself of the bizarre largesse of an award show swag giveaway. He's checked into fancy hotels to find himself welcomed home by staff members and gifted a bottle of his favorite gin. And he has acted in the nude, save for a strategically placed oboe for an Amazon TV series. All of it happened because he became kind of famous, an unlikely Hollywood darling in great demand for a few years after the publication of his first book. And then Hollywood moved on, leaving Hodgman to come to terms with the ways that fame had changed him and who he would be once his moment in the spotlight faded. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Hodgman shares stories of his life before, during, and after the height of his acting career in his memoir Medallion Status, True Stories from Secret Rooms. And he joined us in October to talk about it. John, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I don't really know how to assess your level of fame because I've followed your work for a number of years. You still exist. Mm-hmm. So for me, you're as famous as ever. But you've sensed like an inverted U-curve of recognizability?
Well, I mean, the truth is that I was probably most recognizable when I was on The Daily Show regularly with Jon Stewart as the host. And then, of course, the series of ads I made with Apple Computer and Justin Long, where I was the PC. That was the most humans who had ever laid eyes on me then. Since then, you know, I still do some acting. I was just on The Tick on an Amazon show. But mostly my life is less recognizable now. And it's been a strange adjustment, I have to say.
What do you mean when you say you were often cast as the mustache creep?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, anyone who knows what I look like, and you can Google my face right now, and you will see that an on-camera career was never plausible. I was a writer, and I was invited to present my writing on The Daily Show, and suddenly I got kidnapped by television. And one of the things that happens when you go on television and you start auditioning for and getting roles is you start to see how other people see you. You think of yourself as a nice, decent human being in the world. But it turns out television saw me as one of many different kinds of mustache creeps that I've played. lunatic psychiatrist who have people committed and pull the teeth from their head, to evil FBI investigators who make people cry. And on this TV show that I chronicle, flying back and forth across the country to film, I played sort of the perverted third best friend of the male lead of this comedy. I was sort of the speaker of the house of best friendship. If the first two best friends were something were to happen to them, I would get to step in, I suppose.
All right, I have what I think here is your first ever appearance on The Daily Show.
The areas of my expertise.
That is correct.
It is very funny.
Thank you very much.
And let me ask you this.
Yes.
What are, if I may, the areas of your expertise?
The book covers matters historical, matters literary, matters cryptozoological, hobo matters, food, drink, and cheese, which is a kind of food.
May I stop you? You mentioned hobo matters.
Yes. A great portion of my book is dedicated to the history of the hobos in the United States. Their boxcar hopping, no pants changing ways, and their brief attempt to take over the United States government.
I mean, you are playing a sort of character even in that interview. Were you thinking maybe these guys will love me and they'll ask me to come write for them?
No, I was not thinking that at all. I was thinking, I hope this goes okay. I could feel, I mean, I'm still feeling the fear from that first appearance. Playing that back was fairly traumatic for me, I have to tell you. And also, we both sounded so young.
Yeah.
When I went on The Daily Show, the areas of my expertise, which was my first book, a very weird and absurd book of obviously made-up history, fake facts before anyone was doing them. It was supposed to be like a classic bathroom companion trivia book, but all of the amazing historical true facts were made up by me. You may not realize this, but the hobos of the Great Depression did not actually briefly take over the right. United States government, nor were there 9 U.S. presidents who secretly had hooks for hands. It's all made up nonsense by me, but what I discovered early on and then perfected throughout The Daily Show is that when a straight white man says something with an air of gravitas, people tend to believe him, even if he's saying the craziest things imaginable. And that became my character on The Daily Show, the resident expert, and really defined my career going forward from there.
So you were rewarded there, and in a number of other comedic roles that you played, for landing jokes, yes, as you say, in the biggest, fakest...
We straight white men are often rewarded.
Right.
I'm glad to tell you.
The biggest, fakest way possible. And then you worked with a director who didn't want that, and her note to you was, be smaller.
Yeah, so medallion status sort of charts the latter part of my career. After The Daily Show ended, and I was working on this cable comedy on FX called Married, and I played a small character on the show, and something astonishing happened to me. I had been on a number of TV shows, from Battlestar Galactica to Blind Spot to any number of other things, and what I discovered was that when you are an actor, people will not tell you you're doing a bad job. If you say that to an actual actor, they might get distracted. Mm-hmm. They might go into a depression, or they might go into a funk and storm off the set. It's a vulnerable thing to be an actor. So you don't want to just go up to them and say, you're doing a bad job. And the contrary point of that is that if they tell you you're doing a good job, they're probably lying. They just want to move things along and get their shots. So it was a real sort of moment of hollowing out humiliation on my first day with the woman who was directing this episode, when she took me aside and said, you're not doing a good job. You're mugging. You're making the jokes. Now, I had never been trained as an actor, and so all the training I had had was being very facially and jokily big on camera, both for the ads and for the Daily Show and for other things that I had done. She needed me to be more natural, and I didn't know how to do it. And she couldn't take the time to give me years of training as an actor, so she gave me chores to do. As we walked through the scene, Nat Faxon and I, she gave me things to pick up in the scene and put down in the scene, and papers to shuffle around, and things to move around, just to distract myself so that I would be smaller, as she said, be smaller and be more natural. And it was, as I say, horrifyingly humiliating and gut-punching. But even in that moment of humiliation, I appreciated, this is a great gift that I'm getting. She didn't have to do this. She could have cut around my performance. She could have just taken my bad performance and let me be bad and let my career suffer. But she didn't. She told me what I was doing wrong, and I took that as an opportunity to get better. And I feel like my book is about anything, it's about the therapeutic nature of humiliation.
You know what the Dunning-Kruger effect is? It's the idea that, the less we know about something, the better we think we are at it.
I thank you for defining that, because I was trying to decide whether I should pretend to know what it is, because I've heard about it before, but that would be the Dunning-Kruger effect in action.
Right. Well, no, but I mean, yes, you write about this and about, you know, this director taking you aside. You write about this with great humility, but it makes me think about, you know, ironically, as you're getting better at acting and sort of understanding that it's more than just kind of being good at mugging for the camera, then you have this epiphany that, like, oh, I'm not nearly as good at this as I'd been led to believe. And it's like eating from the fruit of the tree of knowledge, right?
Yeah, no, it was not comfortable at all. And it made me really second guess a lot of my choices going forward. But it was appropriate that I second guess those choices. I mean, there's a story that I relate in the book that's told by Neil Gaiman, who's a friend of mine. He tells it all the time. And therefore, I feel it's entirely appropriate for me to steal it, because it's practically in the public domain. But Neil was at this big event with a lot of high-level celebrities and business people and entertainers and designers, famous people and accomplished people. And an older man was standing next to him at this thing. And the older man said to Neil, I don't know what I'm doing here. I mean, look at all these people. Look at what they've accomplished. What have I ever done? I just went where they told me to go. And Neil Gaiman said, well, I understand, but you are Neil Armstrong. You walked on the moon. That should count for something. And Neil tells that story to illustrate that even the most accomplished people do feel like imposters a lot of the time. The imposter syndrome is something we all suffer. We're all, no matter how good we are at a thing, some part of us worries that we're going to be found out and we're terrible. And that's a comforting thing it's a comforting story to tell. But I think it's an equally comforting story to appreciate sometimes we are imposters. Sometimes we are pushing ourselves beyond the limits of comfortable fraudulency into worlds that we know nothing about. And it is good to be called out when that happens, to be able to resituate and realize I have to learn. I have to do better.
You explain here the logistics of playing a nude scene as a man if there will be no full frontal nudity, right? Which all sounds super technical. There's special, like, flesh-colored socks you choose from. And there's, like,
paperwork.
They're
technically called privacy garments.
Privacy garments. Okay. And there's paperwork like a home equity loan. I mean, it's not just a thing they have you do.
So if anyone wants to see me in the near nude, and I don't recommend it, you can watch... Watch my episode in the first season of Mozart in the Jungle on Amazon. And this was a hard role for me to play because I had been assigned these roles. I knew that the world saw me as a creepy mustache man. And yet here I had been offered this role of a really nice guy, a guy who is an eccentric dilettante for sure, but who sincerely wants to help Lola Kirk's character, who's an aspiring classical musician. That would be a different show. An aspiring classical musician realized she's not an imposter. She deserves to feel that she has integrity as an oboe player. And I give her some very sound life advice. And I'm like, this is so great that I get to play a non-creep for once. And then it turns out in the next episode, I am an imposter. My character is a con man. I'm not who I said I was. And in fact, I'm just taking oboe lessons with her in order to attempt to seduce her by showing up in her bed naked except for an oboe with golden keys. It's a traumatic experience for everyone who sees it, and I'm sorry. But at that point in my career, I knew that if someone invites you to do something challenging or scary, so long as you're not going to hurt yourself or others, you say yes. And so I said, yeah, I'll do this scene. And all of a sudden, I was presented with all this paperwork. It is a literal nude rider to my contract, a piece of paper that explained everything that would be shown and everything that would not be shown, and weirdly written in the first person as though I wrote it. Like, I acknowledge that this part of my body will be shown, and I acknowledge that this part of my body will not be shown, and I agree to all of this. It's not something I ever imagined coming out of my mouth at any time. I had to wear a privacy garment. They forced this on me. I was now willing to be totally naked if that's what they wanted, but the director said, no, thank you. And instead, I got to select from a number of different strange Caucasian flesh-colored panels and thongs and socks. And it was a ridiculous thing because even the Caucasian flesh-colored privacy garments were so much more tanned and robust than my own milky white pallor. I was like, let me be the nude white male monster that I am. And they were like, no, let's not do that at all. Here you go.
You also write about trying to get medallion status on your favorite airline. And like, I work for public radio and, you know, I usually fly Southwest. So there's no secret lounge for me. So will you describe what these places are like?
Well, yeah. When I was flying back and forth across the country to get to L.A. to shoot this comedy that I was on, I didn't realize that as I was flying, I was accruing what are called medallion qualifying miles. I was not aware that I was playing the sick, addictive video game that is the Delta Airlines loyalty rewards program. I didn't understand this until I was checking in for a flight and they saw my boarding pass and they said, ah, Mr. Hodgman, thank you for being gold. Now, this meant thanks for being gold medallion, but to me, I felt a profound shudder of being recognized at last. As an only child, I always thought I was gold, but I was afraid that maybe I wasn't. And now I was being seen as gold. And what's next? Platinum? It's true.
I'm Chris Boyd, and we're listening back to my conversation from October with John Hodgman about his memoir, Medallion Status, True Stories from Secret Rooms. When we come back, John Hodgman describes his attraction to fame.
Most people who go through life, they are not recognized on the street for being on Mozart in the Jungle. Like, hey, I saw you nude with an oboe or whatever. Most people go through their own families without being seen or recognized. And if the one, I think, most intoxicating thing about even the small level of fame that I enjoyed was the number of people who would say, I appreciate what you do, whatever it is that I do. And I have so many weird jobs, I don't even know anymore. That, I think, was the hard thing to let go of.
That's when the best of Think continues. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest is writer, comedian, and actor John Hodgman. His latest memoir is titled Medallion Status, True Stories from Secret Rooms, and he joined us in October to talk about it. Let's return to the conversation. Okay, John, so you achieve gold medallion status. What does that mean for you? How does your life change?
Well, it means nothing. I mean, I guess ostensibly I would get upgraded to business class on certain flights to Columbus, Ohio, if I was going there. Maybe I would get a little bit of priority in terms of when I get to board the same plane we're all going to fly on and get to the same destination at the same time. But it wasn't that. It was this feeling of being seen. You know, one of the reasons that that people, you know, like flying in business class or first class is because you're treated like a real human being, like a whole human being, as opposed to being shoved into an impossible seat that no human can live in. And one of the things that I found that was true about fame and about medallion status, once fame started to wane in my life and I started chasing increasing levels of medallion status through Delta, is that it's such an incredible and powerful thing to be seen. Before the break, I was talking about them saying, thank you for being gold. And it's a dumb thing to say. It's you know, to another human being. But it did, as I say, touch something very deep inside of, like, you see me. You see that I'm gold, right? Most people who go through life, they are not recognized on the street for being on Mozart in the Jungle, like, hey, I saw you nude with an oboe or whatever. Most people go through their own families without being seen or recognized. And if the one, I think, most intoxicating thing about even the small level of fame that I enjoyed was the number of people who would say, I appreciate what you do, whatever it is that I do. And I have so many weird jobs, I don't even know anymore. That, I think, was the hard thing to let go of as, you know, television moved on to a certain degree without me, and appropriately, to people who didn't look like me, different voices, non-straight white men, pretend millionaires saying ridiculous fake facts into the screen. Somehow the appetite for that has gone down in recent years. I'm not sure why. Who knows? You know, less and less commonly, people will come up to me and say, I like what you do. But when it happens, it's still a deep thing. And I've learned from it to say it as much as possible to everyone in my life, because everyone deserves having someone say, thanks for the work you do.
So as you became more famous, more recognizable, you had lots of well-known friends who were genuine friends, but you also had ample opportunities to realize, like, they were more famous than you. So you were asked to be part of a celebrity event to benefit the Children's Hospital in Kansas City. And you walk in. Tell us about that.
I don't know if you've heard of this guy, Paul Rudd. Paul Rudd is an up-and-coming actor that I came to know through comedy circles, and he's a very sweet guy. Everyone in the world loves him because he's all the world lovable. He's incredible. And he and Jason Sudeikis and Rob Riggle, my old friend from The Daily Show, and a number of others, host an annual charity event in Kansas City where they get all their famous friends together to do a bunch of different concerts and events to raise money for the Children's Hospital there. All their very famous friends, and also me. And the most important and sort of touching part of the event is when all of the celebrities and me go to the Children's Hospital and visit the sick kids and their families. It's obviously profoundly humbling and moving to see people dealing on a daily basis with the worst possible news that they ever could have gotten, and ideally surviving it on some level. And there is, on a side note, no better reminder of where you actually stand in the world of celebrity than to go into a family of a sick child and have them look dead-eyed at you and go, where's Paul Rudd? Where's the really famous person? Who are you? And then you have to explain to the sick child and their family, like, I'm John Hodgman. I was on a series of television ads that were on before some of you were born. Maybe you saw my 3-episode arc on Red Oaks as the cable TV station manager. Do you want me to sign something? And the look in their eyes, like, you realize, oh, I'm doing more harm than good. I'm just confusing these people. I'm nothing compared to the most famous person in the world, who is not Paul Rudd at that event, by the way, but in fact is Weird Al Yankovic. Because when Weird Al walks into a hospital room, it's like three grandparents, parents, children, all light up with delight because he has brought so much happiness to the world. He is true intergenerational fame, and he deserves it.
So did you say Coraline a lot when you were trying to tell these kids who you were?
Even I forget sometimes that I was the voice of the father and the other father in the animated film Coraline. That's how I know Neil Gaiman. What's wrong with me? Maybe I should have said that to the young children, but of course that's a terrifying movie. Maybe that would only scare them more.
Right. I'm the imposter that took away Coraline's real dad. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You remember me. I terrified you. And then I turned into a pumpkin. Fun, right? Shall I sign something for you?
All right, so tell us about the hotel, this place that, you know, sometimes you would get put up there, and then you decided you would just pay your own money to stay there because you got treated like a star.
Oh, yeah, the hotel, boy, oh, boy. I used to tell people, this is a famous hotel. I'll not be quiet. I don't mention it in the book because it just feels weird and braggy, but public radio, I'll say. It's the Chateau Marmont.
We're all about name brands here, so yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. It's it became my home away from home for a period of time. At the highest point of my fame, I would be put up there, and then when things, you know, when I was just more or less a working actor, I would take my lodging stipend that I would be paid to go live in L.A. and just throw it at the hotel and then make up the difference just to be there, because you never feel alone when you're at the chateau. You'd be sitting there in the lobby and it feels like a living room, and across the lobby in an overstuffed sofa is like, you know, Charlize Theron. And you're like, oh, we're both kids at the same, we're both siblings in the same house. And tonight we're going to go to a dinner party hosted by our glamorous mother and weird stepdad or something. It just feels, it curates another world. And I used to say to people when they would come visit me there, because I would never leave the hotel if I didn't have to, because why? I would say to them, this isn't the best place in the world. It's the only place in the world. It became quite an addiction that I realized was not very good for me after a while. And then I started staying in the guest rooms of my friend Paul and Janie, and that was a much more humble way to live.
You have long sought siblings from workplaces.
Yeah, so I am an only child, and that means I am a member of the Super Smart Afraid of Conflict Narcissist Club. I spend a lot of time on my own. Terrified of any kind of human confrontation, whether that was an argument or hugging and kissing a person. And so I spent most of my childhood being terribly afraid of sexual adolescence. I dressed like a middle-aged man when I was 15 years old. I cultivated all sorts of affectations. I carried a briefcase. I had a fern in my room. I was basically looking forward to sleeping over sexual adolescence to become the sexless gentleman bachelor I felt destined to become. But because I was such a good boy, I did have a soft spot for a number of different older brother figures in my life. And I talk about working at a movie theater when I was 17, 18, 19 years old, back home in Brookline, Massachusetts, the Coolidge Corner Theater. And basking in the attention of the two Harrys, Harry Snyder, the manager, and Harry Friedman, the projectionist, who were both, you know, wildly funny, risk-taking, irreverent, foul-mouthed, slightly older humans in my life who allowed me to feel empowered to take some risks and be a little foul-mouthed myself.
Hmm. Long before you...
But I give... That's part of my chapter in which I give advice, career advice, to weird 13-year-olds like myself. And what I say is that, you know, your work family... You will find places to work where everyone who works there feels like family. Hmm. And it will be hard not to feel like that's maybe even a better family than your own family. But it's not a family. It's just work. People move on. They realize, I'm too old to be working at this movie theater. They quit. They leave. Works and jobs are appropriate to come to an end. They're not your family. Don't think of it as that.
You tell a number of charming and surprising stories here. The most surprising might be that you worked as a trench digger.
Oh, yeah. I was actually, I think that I must have been 13 or 14 when my friend Tim McGonigal invited me to work a couple of afternoons for his older cousin, who was a contractor. And he and I and some other friends dug ditches. I mean, literal ditches around a house that he was renovating in order to put drainage pipes down. I didn't know how this was going to work. I saw this PVC pipe with holes in it. I was like, those pipes are broken. How is this going to work? That's how little I knew about drainage at the time. I mean, I was truly a naive person. I had all kinds of jobs. Any job, and I think this is still true if you look at my extremely checkered and wide-ranging Wikipedia page, any job that would pay any attention to me, I wanted to have it. As an only child, my desire, as I pointed out, was I wanted to be a grown-up. I didn't want to be a child. And having jobs, even at that age, allowed me to feel a little bit like a grown-up. And even now, you know, I remember feeling when I did a couple of episodes of NBC's Blind Spot, where I played another mean mustache creep, you know, that shoots at Steiner Studios, 20 minutes drive from my house. I would drive to work, park the car, go in and do my work, get the car, and go home. And my favorite part of the job almost was parking my car, because I was like, I feel like a straight up dad going to work here. I feel like a real grown up. And, you know, jobs are like travel. Every job you take is if you're a freelance person, it's like you're visiting a foreign country. Hmm. And every job itself is a kind of secret society or exclusive room. I mean, I'm here at NPR Studios in New York City, and I'm looking around and seeing what everyone is doing and seeing what the culture is here and watching Neil produce me. I like what you do there, Neil. Thank you for your work. I appreciate it. It's just a fascinating journey. Every job that you get to go and do, you get to see a whole new way of living.
It's really interesting, because we're not, our generation of parents, you and I are about the same age, we're not encouraging our kids necessarily to do 58 things. We're saying you better decide if you're going to go to medical school or law school by third grade, because you've got to get on a certain track. And your advice is almost exactly the opposite of that, even though I'll say you went to Yale. So, you know.
Well, I mean, the truth is I didn't understand for a long time that I could afford to be a generalist. You know, my parents both came from working class backgrounds, but they went to college. They were professionals. I was raised in affluent middle class suburb called Brookline, Massachusetts, in affluent middle class. Because I was an only child, I never had to share a thing. I never needed a thing. I applied and got into Yale at my daughter's total shock with a 3.7 GPA.
Yeah.
She's applying to college now. She's like, Dad, you got into Yale on a 3.7? I'm like, it was a different time for young white men. We got forgiven a lot. And of course, when I got to Yale, I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do today. I'm going to read Gabriel Garcia Marquez or just take a nap. And then I saw people who were coming to Yale from different backgrounds, from less affluent backgrounds, obviously different ethnic and racial backgrounds, where this was their family shot. To make the leap that my parents had made, to be the first in their family to go to college. And you can for sure bet that they were not going to go, I'm going to go, you know, have a cocktail at 3 p.m. and then fall asleep with a Jorge Luis Borges story on my face in the middle of the quad. They were going to work.
Yeah.
And, there is obvious merit to dedication. But I think and to hard work and to choosing and thinking about your life practically, I don't think that I could get into Yale now. And I don't think, and I think it's appropriate, that the various life privileges that were afforded to someone who looks like me should not come as automatically as they did even 20 years ago, 30 years ago now, I should say. But I also think that it's important for people to tune into what makes them really happy, to take some time to figure out what they respond to rather than follow a career path that is set for them. Because I guarantee you, you'll be much more successful if you can find out what makes you happy and follow that path. And it's not easy. It's not easy to find out what makes you happy. We all have to be generalists for a little bit to figure out the worlds that we want to travel in.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You share in the acknowledgments that you don't enjoy writing. It nauseates you, but you also can't not write. So help us understand that.
Right. So I was telling a story about my friend Elizabeth Gilbert, the author of Eat, Pray, Love and City of Girls, out now. I can't stop plugging Liz because she's one of my true heroes and inspirations as a writer, and has been since we met in the late 90s. We were both published short stories in the Paris Review, and that's how we met. And she's a luminous, incredible writer. and just a very fun and funny person to be around. And she said to me back then, when I was just starting to write for magazines, and she already had a career in that, she said, "John, why do you write?" And I said, "I don't know. I wish I didn't have to. It's hard. Every time I sit down to write, I worry whether the world needs to have my ideas, whether they should care about my ideas, and whether I even have any ideas to share. I could be out. It's a terrifying thing to confront a blank page, but I can't not do it because I truly think that it's something of an affliction that I go through life in a mediated way where I'm always drawing connections and seeing parallels and seeing themes and sort of writing little essays about what's going on in my life. And it's not a fun way to live. Like, I'd rather just live where I'm just experiencing life. But since I'm doing this anyway," I said to Liz, "I might as well just write it down." And then I said, "Liz, why do you write?" She said, "Well, because it's fun and easy." I'm like, "Boy, Liz Gilbert, how dare you?" And it is for her. It is for certain people.
I mean, do you have to put yourself in character to write? I mean, obviously, you and I are having a funny conversation. Your books have a lot of humor in them. There's also, there are some moments of real pathos and emotion. Do you step outside the sort of you who gets up in the morning and peels a banana and makes coffee in order to sit down and write?
First of all, I don't eat any bananas. Okay. I don't know where you read that.
You know, it's funny. I don't care for bananas either.
It's coming up all the time. Something on the Wikipedia page, I bet. I obviously when I talk about my childhood and my teenagerdom and my affectations, I was creating a character called John Hodgman going way, way, way back. Hmm. And my first three books of humor, starting with the areas of my expertise, the one that put me on The Daily Show, were obviously told from the point of view of a John Hodgman who is a very exaggerated version of myself, a tweety, affected, professorial lunatic. And that's the role that I played on The Daily Show as the resident expert. And then I morphed that into a character called the Deranged Millionaire, which was my riff on Donald Trump circa 2011, 2012, when Trump was going on, just walking onto news sets to talk about birther conspiracies because he was a supposedly rich white man who had something to say right then. I said to Jon Stewart and the executive producers at The Daily Show, "We need someone like that on our show." So I became the quote-unquote deranged millionaire.
I'm Chris Boyd, and we're listening back to my conversation with comedian John Hodgman about his latest memoir, Medallion Status, True Stories from Secret Rooms. When we come back, Hodgman talks about the similarities between fame and parenthood.
We are the most famous person to enter the room. They are so excited to see us. We feel so profoundly seen by our children and wanted and desired and loved. And that is sort of what fame is like.
That's when The Best of Think continues. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest is writer, comedian, and actor John Hodgman. His latest memoir is titled Medallion Status, True Stories from Secret Rooms, and he joined us in October to talk about it. Let's return to the conversation. Since you mentioned Donald Trump a moment ago, you write in the book that your teenage daughter in particular was just devastated by his election. And it occurred to you that...
Yeah, she got the message. I mean, whatever you think about Hillary Clinton, and there's a wide variety of opinion, anyone could see that a highly qualified and accomplished professional politician and world leader who was definitely qualified to be president was beaten in that job by a lazy white male dilettante who just felt like he wanted a job. And that was a rough thing, I think, for all of us to take in. Even the people, I think, who support him. I think no one expected, and least of all he, that this was actually going to happen. And I think, in a weird way, even for Trump supporters who are... our neighbors and our fellow citizens. It's been a weird thing to adjust to and to figure out what it means.
Looking at Trump's interest in fame and recognition, did it help you sort of come to terms with the reality of you perhaps being less famous than you were before, or recognizing that being well known might not be something that lasted forever?
Well, that's the weird thing about fame. Only true sort of damaged people, and I'll say sociopaths, come naturally to fame, come naturally, feel that it has been deserved all along. Most human beings find that it's a strange experience to be seen by strangers and recognized and to live in that other world for a while. So you think, well, this won't last. And you tell yourself, this is just a strange episode in my life and things will go back to normal. And the weird thing about fame is it usually lasts just long enough to make you think, oh, I deserve it and this will last forever. Hmm. And then it tends to go away. So even though I had, you know, prepared myself for this particular strange ride to, if not exactly come to an end, because I still do work, I still voice work and some acting work and so forth, but to not be at the exact, to go down, let's say, from gold medallion status in this real, in this weird world to silver medallion status, which is a garbage medallion, by the way. You know, when it happens, it still feels bad. Yeah. And obviously, you know, you can take two lessons from that, right? You can take the, like, I've got to get it back. I've got to try to claw my way back to the top. I've got to do anything to get people's attention, to keep people talking about me, to keep myself in the public eye, which is a choice that, let's say, maybe the president of the United States makes. And then other choice is, this was fun. And there's something in me that is more important than my status. There is something in me and my relationships that is more substantive than my job title, who's watching me, who's talking about me, where I am on Twitter, what people think of me. You know, one of the people that I spoke to, the woman who interviewed me for Publishers Weekly, pointed out that even though this is a very specific book about my very weird journey through a very specific kind of fame, those of us who are parents have experienced this. When our children are little, we are the most famous person to enter the room. Hmm. They are so excited to see us. We feel so profoundly seen by our children and wanted and desired and loved. And that is sort of what fame is like, except everyone around you. And then we go through the loss of fame, right? Our children grow up. They appropriately develop their own thoughts and feelings and want to have them privately away from you. They start to tell you, Dad, that joke is terrible, as most dad jokes are. And you realize, I'm not that famous person in that person's life anymore. I'm something else. And who am I now? Those jumps down, I should say, you know, falls down in status are something we all deal with. And I think that it's important to remember that we're not our status. We are something more.
It occurred to you, I guess, maybe somewhat after the fact. I mean, you were away from your family at times, taking jobs you didn't, strictly speaking, have to take because the fame was really appealing. And I don't know if maybe you didn't realize in the moment that your kids wouldn't see you as a hero in quite that same way forever. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so, you know, I discuss in the book a little bit about how, you know, once babies, because babies aren't that smart, right? At first they think that when you play peekaboo, your face goes away. And slowly they learn object permanence. They realize, oh, that face is still there. It's just the hands that are covering it up. Those are the jerks. And then they realize that you're going to be there. And that's a good time if you're going to have to travel for work or, I don't know, military service, some other obligation. If it would be away from your kids, actually younger childhood, they're pretty resilient and they're okay with it. And you can rebuild those relationships if you're careful about it when you get home, if you're not away for too long. What I discovered was, for all the traveling I did when my kids were little, it only got bad once they started to reach around 10, 11, 12 years old. Suddenly, they're realizing that not everything is permanent. They're seeing changes in themselves, in their own maturity, in their own bodies. They're turning into little werewolves. It's terrifying. And then a parent being away is not so much fun anymore. It's not so much fun. It's not a game of peekaboo when dad comes back from a trip with presents. You know, it's sort of like, where have you been and why are you going away and what does this mean? I was doing this job and I had a great time working on Married, and I'm so grateful to the show and the creator, Andrew Gerland, for having faith in me and putting me in the show. But it shot in L.A. and I had to fly back and forth and back and forth. And ultimately, I realized this is bad for my family. My son is really getting depressed. Even my daughter, who always was sort of her mental age was 29 and didn't need either of us, was feeling bad. I remember I tried to make it up for them by flying my family out when I was in L.A. for a long stretch and taking my son to Disneyland. And the guy who was showing us around, a friend of mine, Mark McConville, who was a member of the cast at Disneyland, was talking about Disney jail, which is the room they put you in when you get out of hand. And we were laughing about this whole idea. And my son turned to me and he said, Dad, have you ever been to Disney jail? And at first I was like, that's a funny question, kids. But then I was like, oh, wait a minute. What do you think's happening when I'm away from you? Do you think I'm just going to Disneyland all the time without you? That would be a horrible betrayal if you think that's true. And do you think I'm going to Disneyland all the time without you and then getting drunk and going wild and getting thrown? Like, that's not my life. So it's the case that when the show was not picked up for a third season, I met that news with a real sadness because I love my work family, but a certain sense of relief because I love my real family more. So I got grounded.
I think the thing that's really courageous about the way you tell these stories is that you admit that
Thank you. I'm incredibly brave. It's true.
As a white man, I feel like it's important for us to acknowledge your bravery.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for praising this straight white man. I'm getting my due. No, but that's very kind of you to say.
But what's courageous is that you admit, like, you did like being famous. Like, it made you feel special. Because I think a lot of people who had sort of come around to the other side of that would say, it was fine for the moment, but I always knew it wasn't for me. And you don't let yourself have that. You say, yeah, no, it was great.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for seeing me, honestly. Lots of interviewers are like, so the moral of this book is fame isn't what it's cracked up to be, right? I'm like, oh, no, it's great. It's fantastic. I mean, there's a reason that I talk so much about air travel in this. One, because I actually did a lot of air travel. Two, because I did become unhealthily obsessed with getting diamond medallion status on Delta, especially once my show was canceled and I wasn't on TV anymore and I needed something. And three, because you can't tell anyone in the world who's flown first class that it's no good up there. You know, it's great up there. It's great up there because they treat you like a real human being. They treat you like they see you. They treat you like they respect you. And honestly, that's how everyone should treat everybody all the time. But that's not what happens in coach. The day they make it all first class, then we can have a conversation about whether this is really good or bad. I'll agree with you that while fame and first class travel, both literally and figuratively described, is intoxicating, right? And some intoxications can get out of hand and can be bad for you. I will agree with you that flying in first class tends to make you feel more intent upon experiencing first class than thinking about where you're going and why you're getting there and who you're going to see when you get there. To think more about the journey than the destination. You want to get back on first class the minute you get off of that plane, and that's not a healthy place to be. You know, you want to go see your loved ones. That's why you're traveling, you know. But for the most part, it's a great experience that I wish more people could have. It's a shameful thing to acknowledge that we don't see each other and appreciate each other. Fame is one of the ways that people feel seen and appreciated. And particularly if you're a creative person who probably comes from a place of emotional vulnerability, it can be a highly intoxicating drug.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I would like to talk about Judge John Hodgman because this is such an interesting project. There's a column in the New York Times, and then you have a podcast. Yep. Can you, for people who haven't heard, can you explain what this is?
Sure. So I, along with my co-creator, Jesse Thorne, I am the host of a podcast called Judge John Hodgman on the Maximum Fun Podcast Network. I also do a short columnette, as it were, a columnella, a little tiny column in the New York Times Magazine, also called Judge John Hodgman. In both platforms, people come to me with real disputes that they're having, often with a spouse or a partner or a family member, a sibling, a friend, a roommate, or whatever. And they say, my husband thinks he's got the perfect way to load the dishwasher, but he's wrong. Or my husband spies on me using the smart thermostat that we have and changes the temperature on me when I don't want him to. Or my friend and I have been in a fight since college about whether a machine gun qualifies as a robot. And on the podcast, people call in and I listen to both sides of the argument and I tell them who's right and who's wrong. And what usually gets revealed is that there's often something deeper to these conflicts. And it's often a case that people who really feel the need to control their environment do so because they don't feel that their partner or their sibling is actually taking them seriously or hearing what they're saying. So it's a comedy show. We have a lot of laughs, but it's more of an interview show with real people from all different walks of life all over the world. And the column is the same. I just adjudicated one between a wife and a husband who eats hard-boiled eggs, shells and all, right in front of her, saying it's a good source of calcium.
Like a turtle or something. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, he says it's a good source of calcium and there's nothing wrong with that. Well, it's disgusting and it's Eggshells are a good source of calcium, but I don't believe that he is deprived of calcium. I think he is desperate for attention. And if he really wants to eat his eggs that way, he can do so in a dark room alone like he deserves. Those are the sorts of things that I adjudicate on the show and in the column.
How do you make sure that you have people who are going to take it all in the spirit of fun and goodwill? Because, I mean, you know, there are people, I think about the couple that were disagreeing over whether the kids should use a Ouija board or not, like, if, could it, like, bring dark forces or not? And right. you sort of plumbed real territory with the father who was like, I don't know, it just makes me uncomfortable because what if it is real? And what if Satan comes into my kid's bedroom?
Yeah, I mean, you know, behind the simplest disagreements often lurk deep, I don't want to say insecurities because that seems condescending, but preoccupations. You're referring to a couple that, you know, the kids wanted to play around with a Ouija board and the dad was like, I don't feel good about this. And if I remember correctly, he was raised in a household of faith. And while he could acknowledge that a Ouija board is just kind of a slumber party prank, I had to acknowledge that he feels that there is something beyond this world. And I tend to be profoundly agnostic, I guess, or just agnostic, I should say, in the sense that I don't have a gut sense that there is something beyond this world, but it would be arrogant to presume that there isn't something my eyes and senses can't perceive. That's what science has taught us, that there might be something that there might be germs and they're real. And so, you know, I had to honor where he was coming from. And I think and hope that getting him to talk about that in the open allowed his spouse to sort of figure out better where he was coming from and maybe make him feel more comfortable in the ruling. Do you remember the ruling? Because I don't. I often don't remember what I tell people to do. I just remember the conversations.
It's so funny that you're asking me that because I can't remember because you sort of went back and forth and tried to ask different questions. I think in the end you said they shouldn't, the kids shouldn't be allowed to do it if one parent had a real objection to it. But I might very well be wrong about this.
Well, it's a great tease for the podcast. Go check out the archives of Judge John Hodgman. Some of the things, you know, there are some, if the rulings tend to be the anticlimax for me because I just enjoy the conversations the best. But there are some rules that have come out of Judge John Hodgman that I'm grateful that people like think are important in their lives. One of them is people like what they like. You can't, I mean, there's literally no accounting for taste. You can't force your spouse, child, or partner to watch a TV show that they don't want to watch. That's just the way it goes. Be mindful of the work you leave for others. Realize that people are cleaning up after you in this life, both emotionally and literally, and you should leave a tip for your housekeeper in every hotel. Be generous. And of course, if it's not fun for everyone, it's no fun at all. And if I may give one more ruling from the court of Judge John Hodgman, a hot dog is not a sandwich. Don't at me.
All right, there you go. That was my conversation with John Hodgman about his memoir, Medallion Status, True Stories from Secret Rooms. He joined us in October. If you enjoyed this show, you should check out our conversations with W. Kamau Bell about his United Shades of America with W. Kamau Bell show and with Hari Kondabolu about his Netflix special, Warn Your Relatives. Those podcasts are on our website, think.kera.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERA Think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.